Hello, welcome to Music Weekly. I'm Paul McInnes, and on this week's show, we'll be doing things a little bit differently, if that's all right with you. This is our review of the music of the noughties, but fortunately, we can guarantee you a complete absence of lists, and instead promise you the views of some of the producers who have shaped the sounds of the decade. Coming up, we'll be hearing from the people behind the sounds of Nas, Amy Winehouse, Block Party, Katy Perry, and later The Pier, as well as trailblazers and the uniquely British sounds of grime and dubstep. I'll be discussing some of the issues raised in the company of Rosie Swash and Paul Lester, who join me here today. Hello, Rosie.
Hello.
Hello, Paul.
Hello.
But it's impossible to cover everything that's gone on in the last 10 years, but we've tried to speak to some of the people who've made things a little interesting. Our first interviewee is Salaam Remy. He started the decade as an aspiring hip-hop producer, ended it as one of the biggest players in the genre, and with credits on some of the biggest pop albums of the noughties, too. Rosie, Salaam Remy kind of sits right in there with the narrative of how pop music has changed over the course of his 10 years, doesn't he, really?
Well, I think one of the most interesting things about him is, although Mark Ronson gets a lot of the credit for working on Amy Winehouse's sound, Salaam Remy has actually been working with her since the beginning, since Frank, which for many people is just as good an album as Back to Black, if not better. And he's very integral in shaping her sound, and obviously she's one of the biggest stars of the decade. But he also worked on the album Hip Hop Is Dead with Nas, who he's collaborated with throughout his whole career. So when I chatted to him on the phone quite recently, I was interested to know if he agreed with Nas on the state of rap at this time.
I understood what it meant, and I understood where that was coming from. And basically, it was just the whole idea that it was more about marketing. It wasn't even about Hip Hop Is Dead, because hip hop is, you know, one of the most powerful genres of music to come about, and since the end of the last decade, just in general, its influence has touched almost everything. But with Hip Hop Is Dead, it was more about saying that these things are now just about marketing and numbers, and it's not necessarily about the music that we love and the music that we love the feeling of. It's about whatever's going to look good for the mass marketing and numbers. So I understood it, you know, but I let that be his words. And his sarcasm when he did Hip Hop Is Dead is that he used the same sample that we used on the first single from his previous album. If hip hop to die before I wait, I load an extended clip and body him all day. Roll at every station, wreck the DJ. Roll at A station, wreck the DJ. If I'm just died this morning,
and she's dead. Another artist who you've worked with over virtually all of their career is Amy Winehouse. You worked on both her albums, Frank and Back to Black. A lot of stuff is written about Amy, and I'm sure people feel that they know her, but you actually have worked with her very closely. What do you think makes her such a unique or popular artist?
All of the drama aside, she's really focused on her art, and she really likes really good music, and she doesn't let anything go out unless she feels like it's great. So she has a really unique taste. Like, the sound of Black to Black and the feel of that, it all comes from stuff that she had in her iTunes that, you know, we went to old record stores and she would pluck out the songs and the feeling that she wanted from her record. And she's really a driving force. Like, in every record that I produce for her, most of them, I say 95%, she's actually playing guitar in the song and usually starts her songs on guitar to some extent. And she's actually, you know, a real talent. Like, people look at her and they just see the tabloid drama, but the reality is that the guitar on the island alone by herself, or even the piano, and just sitting down and thinking, Amy is able to push out a song when she's ready, as long as she knows what she wants to talk about. He walks away, the sun goes down.
I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about working with Leona Lewis, which I guess is one of your more recent projects. And, I mean, she's another person whose vocal talent is pretty much... Well, she's in a bracket that includes probably Whitney and Mariah Carey, and that's about it. What was she like to work with?
When I worked with Leona, I guess it was at the beginning. I mean, just from looking at her music and now seeing her interviews and stuff, she's definitely grown more into being more comfortable. But her technical ability as far as vocally is something that I hold in very high regard, you know, with the best of them. And at that time, when we were writing for the first album, she was just getting used to it, you know, because some people, as great as they are, they're just not wanting to be put in, you know, into like a fish out of water. Like, here's a new tank, here's a bunch of people, go make a song, that's what you feel from your heart. She can do it, and she's technically able to do it, but she was still growing into who she wanted to be. And what I think was great about the X Factor and the fact that she was able to be so good at that point, and the same thing that I feel about Amy and, you know, most artists that I work with, you know what the potential of Miss Dynamite was on her first album, and most artists that I get to is not only what they are at that time, but what they will be in 5, 10 years, 20 years to come. And I saw that Leona definitely has made her mark from the second that she, you know, was on X Factor, won X Factor, and then made her first couple of albums. But now I see her growing into her own person.
Well, that was Salaam Remy, who raised some interesting points there. But Rosie, I suppose one thing you could say is that it may have started off in a blaze of innovation, taking urban music, hip-hop music, making a more popular sound. Now, by the end of the decade, it sounds like the most overexposed, saturated form of music of all. I mean, do you think that hip-hop is dead as a result?
I think anyone's going to call time on it. It's probably I'm not the best person to do it. But I think what Salaam Remy was saying there that I think is interesting about the marketing of it and all that sort of stuff is that the distinctive traits of hip-hop, two of its distinctive traits. One is that it came from the black communities of America who felt marginalised and oppressed. And secondly, it was capitalist in its nature, which is almost unheard of in music and in other genres. It celebrated money and it celebrated profit. And then has that reached its natural lifespan? Have we got to the point, you know, Jay-Z and Kanye West are two of the biggest artists from the last 10 years, not two of the biggest rappers, two of the biggest people in the world of music. And so I guess what it means is it got so far away from its origins that it doesn't mean anything anymore.
Well, it's interesting actually to say that, because I think Jay-Z's struggling at the moment, isn't he? I mean, he's got his 11th number one album. He's beaten Elvis, but a lot of people feel that creatively he's not where he was. And I think perhaps the best song on the current album, The Blueprint 3, is this Off That, where he talks about, we're no longer into Cristal, we're no longer into bling bling, we've moved on, we're a bit more sophisticated now. And I suppose that is somebody, as an artist, who did talk about all the wealth and the riches of the game and is now trying to work out what to do after that. There has been a lot of debate about this. I think it was maybe Sasha Freya Jones in The New Yorker who tries to write these controversial opinion pieces at the end of the year and suggested that hip-hop might be dead. But it's sparked off a lot of commentary in the blogosphere, has it not, Paul?
Yeah, I mean, even in the world of The Guardian, there have been two very strong pieces recently. One was written by Simon Reynolds, who corroborated the, or confirmed in his opinion the idea that hip-hop was dead, and then there was a counter-argument from Alex McPherson saying that no, there'd been some great music. And you know, if you went back to 1979, you could argue both sides for punk rock was dead by 1979, but nevertheless you could probably say, yeah, but there was that album. I think it's similar maybe situation with hip-hop today. Probably there are some great records being made. I haven't investigated them all fully, but I think the idea that acts with the revolutionary fervour of a Public Enemy, you know, the Clash style, Sex Pistols style, central figures that carry the music forward and retain that central idea of progress and fervour, I think maybe that's gone. And so, yeah, I mean, in a way, they're both true. In a way, hip-hop is dead. There are no almighty figures with important things to say or with an agenda that is looking to the future. At the same time, yeah, there are a series of pretty decent records that maybe could sustain its life well into the next decade.
Okay, well, I suppose it's just really almost like it depends what you're looking for in the music as to whether it's dead or not. But while hip-hop may be teetering on life support, there's one thing that's thriving, so it seems, and that's reality TV, or at least reality talent show TV, the X Factors and American Idols of this world. Rosie, we've seen a lot of artists, particularly in the latter half of this decade, spring from TV shows into recording deals? Are they going to be around in another 5 years?
Oh, God. I can't imagine it dying off, even though poor Joe McElderry had to contend with number two. Partly because, you know, the odd one like Leona Lewis, as Salam Remy said there, I think probably does have a big lifespan, but she's a very unique talent vocally.
I thought it was quite interesting what he was saying there about Leona Lewis, though, because it was very hedged, wasn't it?
She's obviously super shy, you know, not LA, and they're trying to bring that out in her, and God knows what monster that's going to create in the next 3 or 4 years. What I find weird about X Factor's popularity, and I'm speaking as someone who does watch it and who is entertained by it, is it's actually quite regressive. It feels really, really old-fashioned. I don't think it is a particularly new idea, and I'm not just talking about Pop Idol, I'm talking about, you know, years gone by. It feels really variety performance and all that sort of stuff. But I think what works about it, I mean, you know, this year had the biggest ratings ever, is that actually in a weird way there's something very honest about it. It's not trying to be credible. They're not trying to create people with some sort of cool agenda. It's totally naff, and it's not pretending to be anything else. And in a way, if you're, you know, that's one of the few things about music that will always guarantee its popularity, in a sense, is that if someone's being completely themselves, not guarantee its popularity, but if someone's being completely themselves, they've got nothing to hide, that's actually really appealing.
Yeah.
So it's kind of okay to like this naff thing. Is it still going to be around? Who knows? I'm sort of sure Simon Cowell's got more stuff up his sleeve.
It'll be up to 17 judges by 2004. Yeah, exactly. Okay, on to our next interviewee now. The link being that he has also worked with reality TV stars and in the process turned that reality TV star into a genuine international singing superstar. We're talking about Dr. Luke, the man who wrote Kelly Clarkson's Since You've Been Gone and a whole heap of other tracks, Rosie.
Yes, most recently I Kissed a Girl by Katy Perry, which I'm sure everybody knows. He wrote Girlfriend by Avril Lavigne and also Sugar Babes About You Now, which I'm sure people also know.
Yes, and he's kind of he's managed to create a lot of the he's written a lot of the anthemic pop from the past decade. But Kelly Clarkson is the interesting one because that one song almost kind of catapulted her around the world.
I think, yeah, we wanted to talk to him about Since You've Been Gone mainly because it's a track which feels like a rock song in structure, but mm-hmm. totally packaged as a pop song. So when I chatted to him earlier this week, I wanted to know what inspired him to come up with a track like that.
I basically become friends with a guy named Max Martin. I think at the time, both Max and myself were listening to stuff like The Strokes, The Hives, for lack of a better word, indie rock or something, and put a huge big pop chorus on it. And that was the idea.
And obviously you worked with Kelly Clarkson, who is one of the first huge stars to benefit from being on reality TV, from winning a reality TV talent contest style show, which is American Idol. You know, if there's one thing that's characterised pop music in the last 10 years, I think another would be, you know, also with regards to Since You've Been Gone, it's just a complete range of influences and different genres that you hear in pop music, not just the kind of indie rock bands that you mentioned before, but Bangra, hip hop. It's almost like there's no difference now. It's really hard to tell the difference between what is pop and what isn't. And I wondered what particular influences you had over your life, whether you were particularly into hip hop when you were younger or anything like that.
Yeah, like the first record I ever bought was Sugar Hill Gang, Rapper's Delight. I was definitely, as a kid, Run-DMC, and I was interested in, you know, a lot of early hip-hop. Shit, I remember going through a stage where I just listened to, like, hardcore. What we called hardcore. It was like Black Flag, Suicidal Tendencies, Social Distortion, stuff like that. I don't know, I went through different phases. I went through one phase when I went to music school for a little bit, where, like, I only listened to jazz for pretty much 2 years, you know, because I was really wanted to be good at that and learn how to do that. Learning about harmony and chords and stuff like that definitely helped me to this day with like stuff like problem solving in songs and trying to figure out why something doesn't work or figuring out different options and stuff like that. And I definitely know what you mean about it seems like the boundaries have changed right now, you know, in the past 10 years. I agree with you, like, because I think before I grew up, but even while I was growing up a little bit, like, I think back in the day you had to, like, either like the Stones or the Beatles, and there's like separate camps, and you couldn't like this kind of music and that kind of music, where now I feel everybody just likes whatever they like. But I think there's something about that kind of music and being like a teenager and just rebellion and like, you know, this is, it's a phase, it's a, there's an energy in it. At that time, it's, you know, I think it was probably less accepted by your parents and kind of, it was your own thing that your parents didn't like.
You know, does that relate to I Kissed a Girl, you know, for example, which is, you know, I'm sure a lot of people find it a little risque for the charts.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of, you know, letters from parents to, you know, radio stations in the South about, like, you know, how they picked up their, you know, daughter from basketball practice or ballet or something, and coming back in their car and they heard I Kissed a Girl and their daughter was singing it, and they were outraged. There was a sign, actually, I have a picture of it, of like this church in the South that said, quote, I kissed a girl and then I went to hell.
Sorry,
I'm not sure they really thought that one through. No. It was pretty odd because I think both men and women were probably looking at that sign.
Yeah.
Okay, that's Dr. Luke there, who got his doctorate in listening to jazz consistently for 2 years. So, Rosie, I suppose the first question I'd like to ask you, with on the back of that, is what is pop?
Listening to what he just said in that one answer. This is a man who wrote "I Kissed a Girl" by Katy Perry, and he's talking about growing up listening to Black Flag and Suicidal Tendencies, which is quite a weird thing to say. What pop is now? It makes me think of being at university in 2001, and the Strokes were the thing that everyone was listening to at that time. But the biggest song that was still being played every time you went out, well, it was Manchester, so it was fucking Happy Mondays and all that stuff, but in everywhere I went at that time, was Hit Me Baby One More Time by Britney Spears. And I thought, for some reason, that song seemed to totally capture a point where people's attention went back to pop, you know, for a multitude of reasons.
Paula, do you think there's anything that can be excluded from pop?
To be honest, I mean, that track we just heard, you know, the Dr. Luke track, that's a rock song for me. And I actually think, you know, about hip hop, I think pop is dead. I think there have only been two pop songs, maybe three, this whole decade.
Really?
Toxic by Britney, Can't Get You Out of My Head by Kylie, and I would struggle thereafter to find a third. I don't know what the production techniques, I don't know what the instruments are that they use, but to me, whatever is going on those records is pop. There is no other word for it. It's not urban. It's not R&B. It's not synth pop. It's not electronica. It's just pop. And I presumably no one else knows how to pursue that line of inquiry, because no one else has really followed up on those two absolutely magnificent pieces of music. One of them was co-written by a bloke from Mud, a 70s glam band. I mean, it's astonishing, really. But it just shows you just how kind of clueless we still are about the sort of the magic and the alchemy of it all. With all the technology we've got and all the knowledge we've got, we've heard so many records in our lives. We've got the iPod, which just levels out the whole of musical history before us. I think there still only have been those two.
That's fascinating. But there's something about the iPod, isn't there, as well? He's talking about, you know, that the Stones and the Beatles, and you like one or the other, and you only have certain tastes. The iPod has meant really that you can carry the whole of the world's music in your pocket, and you can listen to it all and find with which songs within which genres are to your taste.
And shuffle between them. So you'd be listening to one song at 1 second, a completely different kind of song the next. I think I personally feel that it's key. I'm sure there are people that have other arguments for why music appears to be, you know, the genres, the boundaries between genres appear to be so blurred at the moment. But that, I think, is completely key as to why people are no longer so attached to what they're listening to. Maybe kids are, you know, maybe emo kids are really strict about not listening to other kinds of things. But it certainly feels like the accessibility of different genres is part of the reasons why we're no longer so sure about how we can classify them.
Yeah. That's a really interesting debate there, people. Thank you so much for that. And we're going to move on, though. We've got some more people to talk to. In the middle of the decade, the key adjective in British rock was angular. It was used to describe the spiky, punctuated post-punk music made by bands like Bloc Party, Maximo Park and the Futureheads. These bands had one thing in common, and that was producer Paul Epworth. Epworth has returned to prominence at the end of the decade, working with acts like Friendly Fires, Jack Pagnotte, and most recently, and successfully, Florence and the Machine. Tim Jones caught up with him to get his views on all things noughties, but first, here's Florence with the Epworth-produced Dog Days Are Over.
So at the start of the decade, guitar music was in a bit of a miserable state, some would say. I mean, what do you think changed all that? Because this really has been a decade where guitar music has totally taken off.
I don't know. I mean, I think maybe bands were listening to more different kinds of music, and I think that was kind of reinterpreted in some way, you know. I think the fact that the resurgence of the Strokes after a long time of dance music and fairly bland pop... Mm-hmm. And the, you know, I think the Rapture obviously had quite a influence on some of the UK bands that started to kind of use sort of dance rhythms with guitars.
Bloc Party, a lot of people kind of associate you with. They were, you know, almost a standard guitar band, but there was obviously a dance element that was brought to it, and that's what made them so exciting. Was that your idea? Was it Kelly's idea, or was it just a group kind of decision?
From their initial recordings that I think they'd just done with Matt, the drummer, they tried to, you know, they were incorporating some of the things like A Certain Ratio, and which were obviously like bands from that era were incorporating a lot of dance music in their sound and a lot of, you know, rhythmic complexities in their sound. It kind of felt kind of natural. I think the one thing we did try and do was just try and treat the rhythm track like a dance record, essentially. So the drums were kind of not necessarily looped up, but we paid attention to it being sort of the rhythm track being really solid. I guess in the back of our minds there was a little bit of us that just thought, you know, this needs to be played in the club like trash. You know, this is a way that you reach an audience who will take your record to heart. You know,
that's one of the big stories of guitar music of the decade. That actually. In the 90s, you go to an indie club, and it was, in the late 90s, a very depressing experience. It was, you know, James, Oasis, Blur, and it felt like time hadn't moved on at all. But then in this decade, you know, clubs like Trash, suddenly every kind of record had to be quite sexy, had to make sense on the dance floor.
The process that was begun then has been a bit of a story this decade in how kind of homogenised music's become, in the fact that, you know, subgenres are spawning subgenres, and... A lot of contemporary dance music is referenced, you know, is a lot, you know, incorporating a lot more live instrumentation. I think everything's blending together a bit, but I think, you know, maybe that was part of the transition to where we're at now, is that basically, you know, bands were paying attention to not just making records for gigs, they were making records that could be played anywhere, you know, and I guess probably, and in some ways, if you look at it, compete with other things on radio.
And you touched on that with your remixing as well. The Phones remixes and stuff like the Futureheads' Hounds of Love, you know, it became a massive kind of anthem. Is that something you're proud of, to have that?
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I feel the urge to move on very fast. And it's why I've tried to choose different projects that offer some breadth to my, for me to be able to express my musical taste. I really enjoyed doing all those mixes, and it was great fun. I just can't believe how many I did so fast. Yeah, I can't work like that these days.
That was Paul Epworth talking to our very own Tim Jones. So, Rosie, Epworth there is talking about the homogenised nature of the music scene at the turn of the decade. Is that something you recollect from your Manchester discos?
Well, not my Manchester discos. When I was sort of 16, 17, I used to go to a lot of indie clubs in London, quite far away from where Tim James was going to. Obviously, exactly the same crap was being played. You know, James and all the stuff that he talks about there, very reminiscent of that. And also, you know, Britpop and the bands that you associate with that, it was kind of cheeky. It was really British. There was something quite lame about the bulk of those bands. And then suddenly the Strokes came along with a sound that, although it wasn't completely new and it was very much influenced by New York's sort of post-punk bands like Television, it was new at that time. No one else was doing that. And they had this kind of debauched, gauche kind of image. The music was quite phenomenal. I still think that album's great. And it spawned a complete change in the direction that indie bands were going. The Libertines, who don't sound that much like the Strokes, but certainly share elements with them, always talk about the Strokes being really integral to them as a band. He also said stuff like the Rakes and the Hives. At the time, people were really into them, but, you know, give it a few years now, even remembering back, I can't see why anyone was that captured by those bands.
They all blur into a bunch of skinny ties.
So basically, yeah, you got the Strokes kicking off a new set of homogenised, angular, you know, twangy bands.
What one thing and the Strokes, I suppose, also by bringing kids back to the dance floor again, might have kicked off was this move from DJ to artist, I suppose, producer, backroom boffin to front of stage performer, Paul.
Yeah, I mean, Paul Epworth, I have consistently seen his name on records. I don't know what his signature is. I mean, I do struggle to recognise what it is he's doing.
That's quite interesting, isn't it? Because I think that these albums that he's produced this year, and the Jack Pagnotte thing is cleverly reworking all that Afro pop that was around. Florence is a I suppose a pastiche maybe of the sound that Bat for Lashes has been crafting. He's somebody who can. He's obviously got a magpie ear for things.
Maybe that's what it is. I mean, I'd love a serious musicologist, and God knows I am far from being
that serious being musicologist.
One of those. I'd love one of them to come along and say, well, actually, this is what he's doing. I know what Trevor Horn did. I know exactly what he did. Thereafter, I really struggle. But I know that Epworth is a very important figure. And actually, he probably would agree with that because he's making his own music to be released in 2010. And I know we're looking back at the noughties. I think maybe one of the things we're going to see more often in the next decade is producers doing their own music in the way that Mark Ronson did. Because why not? Why wouldn't you? You've got so much knowledge at your disposal
and so much technology
and the means of doing it. It would be almost foolish not to at least attempt it. I think Starsmith has probably got a decent record in him, and maybe they'll take their cue from that.
I mean, I think that's quite interesting, the point you make, because I think a lot of bands are going the other way as well, into becoming more producer-like, and it's because of the drop in price and the rise in innovation in the technology that means. I was talking to this guy who's in a punk band who was telling me about all the pedals he owned. And that basically through the investment of maybe £350 stretched over the course of a year, he's got a full. He can make himself and his drummer sound like a five-piece band, and they can add X number of digital effects on top to create something which is quite limited in terms of the instruments that make a really rich sound.
If you're going to see more of actually what our next interviewee talks about, which is more freely available software to produce your own tracks that isn't expensive, maybe you're going to get people going away from the sounding like everybody else thing, or what does this band, you know, who does this band sound like? People that are actually capable of sounding completely fresh and original because their only inspiration is what's in front of them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's move on to that next interview now. Paul Epworth mentioned the importance of getting songs played in clubs like Trash. And our next interviewee is the man who started that iconic North London night. It's none other than Errol Alkan. Rosie, I think that if there's any one person in the UK who's a touchstone for all the good things that have come out in UK music, it might be Errol.
I would agree with you. He started off in his late teens almost exclusively an indie DJ, and then managed to inadvertently rebrand himself as an electro DJ. during this time, he started Trash, which was a club night, but also a live bands night, which was not that common back then. And now he sort of in the middle of that, was a part of the mashup craze, which we talk about in the interview, and then saw out the decade with being involved with New Rave, but also bands like Mystery Jets and producing bands like Long Blonde. So he's kind of had his finger in all of the pies. And one of the things I wanted to take him back to was Trash, which is obviously over now, very sad. But I wanted to know why it was different from your average indie club night.
I'd been to clubs, you know, all my life, and, you know, there'd be a band come on and play and stuff. But usually in the clubs I used to go to, when a band would come on, everyone would, you know, go into the back room where there's a DJ again. It didn't really seem to be that interested in bands, which I find quite ironic, seeing it was like, you know, an indie club, an alternative club. But the way that we did it at Trash, we'd only put a band on that we all agreed that we liked, and one that we felt we'd already broken on the dance floor, and also one that we felt was one we were putting on at a time which would feel exciting, not at any point it be something that we were kind of capitalising on, you know, by booking someone that was going to be hot at that point.
Let's talk about the phenomenon of mashups. Okay. And Curtis Rush. So Kylie's Can't Get You Out of My Head, New Order's Blue Monday, it was in the Brits. It was this huge, people just remember people reacting to it like, wow, what is this? I can't believe people can do this.
The first one that I did, I think, was a Speed Garage version of Loveful by the Cardigans, like R.I.P. Groove or something. That was literally just messing about at home with an a cappella and a CD that I'd borrowed from the library, you know, sort of, and kind of putting the two things together and dubbing it onto mini disc, and then after that taking it off mini disc and putting it onto CD and playing it in clubs. And the same thing happened, I think it was 2000 or 2001, with the Sugar Babes one and Forget About Dre. You know, all these things were just trying to find interesting tracks that kind of juxtaposed against each other, you know. I'd been playing Can't Get You Out of My Head with Blue Monday together, like mixing the opening kicks over the top of it and stuff like that, just to kind of, you know, hype it in the club and stuff. Now, like, truth be known, I'll say at the end of the decade thing, I didn't particularly want to do it. I felt that by kind of mashing it up, it almost like kind of cheapened Blue Monday a little bit. Being a bad person, I only agreed to it so that way I could get the a cappella of Kylie, which was the most sought after a cappella at the time. It was like it was the gold dust of a cappellas. I kind of said, yeah, of course, you know, yeah, send us the a cappella. And they did.
One of the other things that the you know, Danger Mouse in particular felt this, but the mashup side of things almost foretold what's happening now, which is copyright infringement.
Mm-hmm.
And that was almost the start when labels started to think, hang on a second, we don't really have control of this. Did you ever get in any trouble or experience any problems?
No, the only things I experienced were when the actual labels who I'd used their music actually pressed up the records themselves and made it look like it was done anonymously.
So you didn't get anything for it, but they...
No, I didn't get anything. No, yeah, they capitalised. But it's fine, you know. I think there were people who kind of viewed it for the creative and exciting thing that it was at that time. And then there was the copyright thing. But now, kind of looking at it, it's almost like people are encouraging other people to sample you now. You know, they're sort of... They want you to use elements of their recordings because they know that if it's successful, then they will reap the benefits of it later down the line. What you know about to the food, let me know. You didn't see like see, let me know. If you didn't try me on me, let me know. I'm about to press like tea, let me know. There are entire songs constructed completely from samples that are found on, that are given away on software. Well, I tell you a good example of that is actually Umbrella by Rihanna, which all the drum sounds are from GarageBand.
And it's got like some chords, and that's the sum of the track.
That's all it is. And you know what? The funny thing is that, you know, a lot of the really big producers and those big records that made the big R&B things, it's all preset sounds. They're all using microcords, you know, and sort of and GarageBand drum sounds, and they're making huge hits out of it. So, you know, it's... just goes to show, really, you don't need the you know, all the bells and whistles that, that you're told that you do need.
That was Errol Alkan, a man who knows his software. I guess we want to know who makes the drum patterns on the microcorgs, then, don't we? So, Paul, first of all, I think you've got a confession to make about an act, an audacious act of musical terrorism you committed.
Yeah, I invented mashup culture. It was at the height of the first Gulf War, and I was sitting in my friend Bob's flat in Crouch End, and he had a computer, and actually, you know, it seemed like an obvious thing to do, to splice two songs together. So we got the beat, the shuffling beat from Groovers in the Heart by D-Light, and we put over the top of it, we had to vary speed it a little bit, and we had to slow it down a bit. Todd Rundgren's I Saw the Light, officially Judy Burchill's favourite single of all time, fact fans, and Tony Blackburn Record of the Week in 1973. So we put those two together from different eras, and they worked brilliantly. So, and then nothing was heard about this, you know, crazy idea for another 10 years, and then suddenly too many DJs came along and completely stole my thunder and my record collection and my idea.
It's a bit like Marty McFly in Back to the Future. Yeah. The kids just weren't ready for it yet, yeah. Were they? Yeah, stick that, Alkan. So Rosie, you're talking in the interview there about copyright.
Yes.
And it was something whereby lawsuits began to descend on artists as the decades progressed.
I think it was Danger Mouse with the Beatles, Jay-Z mashup Bonanza that everyone got so excited about, and now just sounds
the grey album
just sounds quite lame, although to be fair I did think it was quite lame at the time. Anyway, EMI cease and desist order went absolutely nuts over it, and if you're going to do, you know, if you're going to attract anyone's attention, you pick the biggest band in the world, it's going to work. So I think that was the first time that we started to see the labels scratching their heads going, hang on a second, maybe we've got a problem here. It's interesting what Errol was saying, because his attitude is that people at the labels, you know, at that particular time, with the Blue Monday mashup, for as an example, weren't worried about it so much because they saw it as giving songs a new lease of life. They thought they could make money out of it, and they obviously thought it was quite small time. But what they didn't see coming was what the digital revolution would do to their profits, and they sort of didn't make the connection. I don't, you know, maybe they did and they didn't do anything about it, but it seems they didn't make the connection between people being able to do whatever they wanted with music digitally might mean that they might not want to pay loads of money.
And they might be able to get it whenever they wanted and
exactly.
However they wanted. Very interesting. Okay, moving on now. We were speaking about US hip-hop at the start of the show, but UK urban artists have been every bit as innovative. Two distinct new sounds emerged from Britain this decade, dubstep and grime. We'll come on to dubstep shortly, but first we're going to meet the Esky Boy. That's Wiley. As part of the Pay As You Go cartel and onwards into the Roll Deep collective, Wiley was one of the fathers of grime. He gave a leg up to Dizzy Rascal, then fell out with him, and has had a prolific recording career, both through mixtapes and official releases on a nigh on endless number of record labels. Now, he's innovated all the way throughout his career.
Exactly.
And that might have had an influence on Wiley himself, huh, Rosie?
Well, he does refer to himself in the third person quite a lot throughout this interview, just to warn you. I'm not sure whether that's an ego thing or not. We'll let the listeners decide. But I got him on the phone quite recently, and I wanted to get his take on what was happening in the early days of grime and his opinion on how the sound developed.
A lot of pirate radio, a lot of events, like club events, a lot of like crews. Like, but also the crews being the individuals in the crews, they unify with each other. See, like Dizzy Rascal was one of the very first. Obviously, Wiley, Roll Deep, everyone was about Kano, Sharky Major. If you look at Dizzy Rascal, he definitely sort of triggered it for everyone.
Yo, if a girl know where you say that for, some girl banging at your girl, what for? Pregnant, what are you talking about? You saw 15, she's underage, that's raw. And against law, 5 years or more. And she wants a score and a half of a draw. That's the kind of threat that you can't ignore. That whore got you pinned down to the floor, but shut up, you said three magic words.
Part of the media coverage of grime was like, here's this new sound, it's the future, it's going to be huge. Do you feel that in a way...
it is huge.
It is huge, but it's not being covered in the media
huge.
Anymore.
You know why it's huge? Because where did Tinty Strider come from? And where did Chipmunk come from? Where did Dizzy come from? Where did Kano, Wiley,
anyone who is anyone. They all came from this, so it is huge. That's what I think. I think everyone's looking at it like grime is dead. It couldn't be dead, otherwise Dizzy Rascal and Wiley and Dingy and all these people, we wouldn't be in the chart, would we?
One of the things I wanted to ask you about was, if I go and look at your videos on YouTube now, a lot of them are posted up there, and in capital letters it says, if you like this song, support the movement and purchase the CD. Are you strongly anti people downloading, taking your music for free, sharing
your music?
No,
I don't care about downloading. The thing is that a downloader, I can't hate a downloader, because it don't make sense. You'd be a hypocrite. So everyone in the whole world has downloaded something, if they're computer literate, if they wanted that new Rihanna song or that new Chris Brown or whatever they wanted, everyone's done it. So downloading, I try not to get into it. Like, I don't really care about it. I just hope that when I bring something out, everyone buys it. I can't sit here and say, shit, downloads, man, they're affecting us. Because they're not affecting me anyway. They're affecting people who maybe once sold millions and millions of copies, and now they don't. You know what I mean?
So what do you think is the next step? What do you see happening in the next 5 or 10 years?
The next step is we become millionaires, because that's what we all want to become. Some of us are closer than others.
And what do you say to people that think maybe that you have to compromise yourself or your music to do that? Is that how you feel?
Yeah, no, you know what? I don't say nothing to them anymore, because they don't have to compromise. They with all the compromising's been done. Dizzy's done Dance With Me, Bonkers. He's done Rolex. We've all done it now. I think that next year we could just do Grime if we want. That's what I do believe.
So Grime is still going, and it's still the future.
Yeah, it's still the future. Dubstep jumps in front. It feels like it has, but it's got no voice. Grime is like the equivalent to hip hop, and it's the only equivalent. You're gonna know drum and bass. No one else ain't come closer than us.
As in drum and bass, and now dubstep, they don't have a message.
Yeah, like they all, every genre, from Hijack to Rodney P to Black Twang to anyone. You ain't come closer to crossing that Atlantic than we have. So we Wiley and everyone younger than him, obviously we've made big steps, very big steps that no one else in this country's made yet. And if we follow through, you know what I mean, Kano, Ghetto, Scorcher, Skepta, JME, if we have the whole thing out there, can't be touched. One glass of champagne for me, two glass of
champagne for you, three, now do the Rolex sweep. So, Rosie, that was Wiley, and I've only got one question for you. Is it huge?
What, grime music?
Well, Rosie, take it as thinks, however you want.
Rosie thinks. Yeah, of course it is, in bow. I think it's what he was saying was like half right and half not. I think it was, you know, obviously his perspective is going to be different from mine, and I don't want to disagree on the man who's so clearly still involved in the scene. But grime, you know, doesn't exist in the charts. That's not what is selling loads. It's grime artists doing completely different kinds of music, and he seems to be missing what I think is the connection. There is that people don't have any objection to these MCs being in the charts. They have no objection to buying it. They just don't want to buy grime music, and therefore grime music is not commercially successful because people don't want to buy it.
Yeah, I mean, certainly not stuff with an edge. I mean, I think, you know, when he's talking about, particularly about Tingy Strider, that flow that he has, it's still, you can still pick up the grime elements to it, but it's undoubtedly been changed and made more pop, more hip-hop.
Yeah, you can. I mean, it was quite striking. It was I Love You being played underneath what Wiley was saying, and then bits from Wearing My Rolex. I mean, one is future music from the year 2017, and one is a really nice commercial dance track. I really like them both, actually. I know there was. I mean, I'm terrified even talking about grime, because the level of intelligence is brought to bear on this subject by the people in the blogosphere, like Simon Reynolds and people like that. I daren't even address the subject. Nevertheless, I did see some posts. You know, there's quite a broad spectrum of feeling about Dizzy Rascal's so-called commercialization. I really like Bonkers and Holiday. I think they were both good in a different way to the earlier, more kind of eccentric, cut up and scarily, icily, futuristic stuff. But I could see why people would take offence, maybe because they felt like, well, this is a music that should be much more popular, and then maybe taking umbrage at that, having to sort of slow it down a little bit and stretch it out a little bit and make it more palatable. Yeah.
And all that remains is the tone of voice and the turns of phrase and occasionally a bit of the flow, but the musically it's just gone in a completely different
way. Well, direction. I like the dunderheaded simplicity of it. I really like Wiley's Take That. I mean, it is a kind of a schoolyard chant, Take That, and you know, it's almost like Oi to sort of post-punk. They both happened about the same time, but one was just really moronic. But you know, it's got an attractive, because of that, it's got a quality to it.
Yeah, we might be coming on to the digital post-punk equivalent in a minute, but I'd like to address this, the illegal downloading issue, while he brings it up there. It's obviously been a massive topic for music in the noughties. Do you think that people download and then buy that same CD, Rosie?
I have done, myself personally. Proof, there you go. Absolutely, the answer's yes. I think the reason I wanted to talk to him about that issue in particular is because it's not that no one was interested in grime, it's just that their audience weren't buying it, and he didn't seem to want to like play ball with that. But you know, put in a pirate radio, no one profits from that, and you listen to it for free, and if you can download everything for free, how's the scene going to survive if no one? And it was one of the first scenes that came along during that time, so really all you've got is club nights. I think what the only thing that's really going to save the music industry, if it doesn't change now, is a watershed moment where people, or a sea change rather, in people's attitudes. And personally, at the beginning of this decade, I got LimeWire on my computer and I thought it was brilliant, and it didn't even occur to me that I was stealing. Like, it sounds completely stupid now, but I just thought it was such a new thing, and it was such a new piece of software. I just thought it was amazing. I didn't even know until years later that I was also sharing my music by being online. I didn't know anything about it. And it was only relatively recently where I thought, this is actually wrong and I don't want to take people's music for free. So it's not fair.
Here's a thing. I was looking at the a list of albums that have sold big in the States this year. And I noticed Raekwon and his Only Built for Cuban Links 2 sold 141,000 copies in the US, which is not bad going for a guy who is probably, certainly is past his peak and has not made a huge fortune out of rap music. And
the fifth best known member of the Wu-Tang Clan.
The reason I think this is interesting is because he's put out, he built up to this album by putting out at least a couple of mixtapes, by doing loads of YouTube videos, all of which had that recurrent message, like you were pointing out about Wiley, saying, if you like this, then go and buy the actual CD. Yeah. And the idea that he built a fan base by using social media and then managed to turn that fan base into paying consumers at the end of it all. And this is something that Lil Wayne did to a far greater effect last year. But that's what I wonder, whether that's what Wiley's hoping for, that you build that audience and you try and get the numbers up. Because I think if you are talking about grime listeners, it's probably not all that many people who are listening to the pirate radio in the first place. Probably not enough people to drive it into the charts anyway. So you build it up using social media and then you turn it into sales. Anyway, better wrap that up because we've got another interview to squeeze in now. And it's time for our final producer. It's Benga. Benga is one of the people who've driven the development of dubstep since it emerged from London as a fusion of dub and two-step garage at the beginning of the decade. With a critical credibility, it's championed by everyone from John Peel to Tom York, which is why I think this might be the post-punk to the Oi. It's often a sophisticated blend of syncopated beats and rib-juddering bass lines. We can hear Rosie's interview with Benga shortly, but first, here's his 2008 dubstep anthem, Night.
So what was the trigger for your move into the darker sound, into dubstep? Was it something quite subtle, or was it hearing a particular record?
Yeah, I think it was like one or two records that switched me over completely. I used to go into a record shop called Big Apple, and one of the main DJs in dubstep today used to work there, called Hatcher, when he was quite young as well. he used to feed me records, and I always just turn down the dark stuff and just take the stuff that I knew and heard out. And then he gave me Scrappy, like Down on Me, a Wookiee record. And after that, I was just like, I want more of that stuff. And that was it. I just went straight down the LB sort of Zed Bias and Wookiee line, and I never looked back.
What is it about the dubstep sound that you love so much?
I guess it wasn't dubstep at the time, it was two-step. And I think the drum patterns, the tempo, but it was like, it wasn't just dark, it was like melodic. He had wicked chords and wicked hooks and stuff.
It seems that a lot of the dubstep producers come from, you know, particularly sort of South London, Croydon, those kind of built-up areas. What kind of influence has the region that you live in and still live in had over your music?
Two things, really. I guess the fact that it wasn't really loads for us to do, so it was either be out on the streets loafing or making beats. Number two being that the record store is there. I think it has anything else to do with like the music that's around the town or what's in the town centre. It's the record store, the Big Apple.
And what about clubs like Forward and DMZ? What would you say makes them, or made them so special, makes them so special?
Well, they were the earliest nights booking us all. So if you wanted to go to a night to catch me, Scream, Mella, had to end up at the same thing, the only place you would get it would be Forward or DMZ.
What would you say the first, you know, crossover dubstep track would be, in your opinion?
Crystal Line by Scream, with ease.
What do you think it was about that track in particular that allowed it to transcend just the circles that people were initially listening to it in?
I guess apart from the fact it was different, there was things in the song that people could relate to, like the arpeggio and stuff, people could understand that. The thing about songs that cross over from our scene, there's little bits in it that people can relate to, whether it's a little vocal line, it's a hook. It's mainly the hooks, I guess. And Chris Hine had a good hook.
That was Benga there, the final interviewee in our Noughties special. Rosie, this is I suppose dubstep, one of the reasons why it's become so critically renowned is that it is a very different sound.
I think one of the main things that's interesting about it is it's led by the bass and by the dub that you hit, that you hear is the main thing that you hear, and that's what everything's hinged around, which is completely unusual for dance music. Usually it's the beat and the percussion. What Benga was talking about in the interview about two-step and the subtle ways that he heard it changing was that two-step itself was innovative in that dance music, house music, is four to the floor. It's quite a dry, a standard house beat, and two-step it was jittery, it's offbeat, it's just slightly unusual, so it's like the next progression of what they're doing with the percussion to make it interesting. And in this case, it's kind of taken a complete back seat, so it's the first time that dance music has been led by something that isn't the percussion. I guess and
yet it's still a club driven phenomenon, Paul.
Well, I was just going to say that it is, because you said it was, the dubstep was very highly critically acclaimed, and you know, it was one of the first musics I can remember where it's almost completely instrumental, and yet it's generated reams and reams of critical kind of analysis.
Why do you think that is?
Well, apart from that, it's brilliant. I mean, it's, you know, dub was great, and two-step was great.
Put them together.
Yeah,
what
I mean, dark electronic dance music. What's not to like? I'm looking forward to sort of, you know, singer-songwriters like Ellie Goulding and people like the way Amy Winehouse did with Salaam Raimi, you know, incorporating this stuff into what they do, and maybe that being not just a crossover, but a really big hit that brings the dubstep recording techniques into people's homes.
one of the things that my brother, who's a regular attendee at Forward, likes to say is that it's not a particularly mixed gender crowd. And I think a lot of the people you're talking about here, the critics, are usually men who rave about dubstep, aren't they? It's that dark dance music is for it to actually kind of get out of its normal fan base. It might need the pairing up with the female vocals, the LaRue remix to
feminize
it.
Yeah, I mean, I think I really like two step. I didn't like drum and bass, but and I think was two step the next logical progression on from drum and bass, because yeah. I like that because it was more feminized and had girly vocals, it had more melody. But you know, I'm swearing by this 5 years of hyperdub compilation that I bought on the back of a great Guardian article by Dan Hancock's, and there are tracks like Dark Stars, 80s Girls, A Computer, which is a move in that it is very melodic, and it's got kind of albeit computerized, blippy female vocal interpolated into the beat, and it's kind of, I don't know if it's warming it up, but it's maybe making it more approachable, and that may be something that's going to be happening more in 2010.
One of the people that was picked in various polls for next year was Joy Orbison, and I personally really like him because he's two-step. It's like the next stage to what the sound is. So maybe actually dubstep was the genre that emerged over the 2000s, and actually that's what we should be looking for next year.
So while dubstep itself might never break out, it'll be the genre that influences next generation of music. Very interesting, Rosie. Thank you so much. And thank you very much to you too, Paul Lester.
You're very welcome. I was pretty good, wasn't I?
Yeah, you were pretty good.
I was nervous about today because, you know, in the I was saying this to Rosie before, in the noughties I was listening to sort of French disco and twitchy US R&B and recently chill wave, and I really like the new wave of shoegazing groups like Radio Department and Americana and all this stuff. We didn't get to address any of that. You picked the three or four things that I had no idea about. So I was very edgy. I've lost weight and I'm kind of, you know.
But that just goes to show the remarkable diversity of music in the noughties.
Yeah, it really has. I mean, there's loads and...
We should point out that we know that there's going to be lots of people that tune into this and wonder where their favourite et cetera are. And there's loads of things that we wanted to cover and we couldn't. And there's loads of people we invited to take part in this show, not panelists, interviewees, who didn't either. So we haven't got time in an hour to cover absolutely everything.
No. We want to reassure Paul that we didn't contact any other panellists.
No,
we wanted
did not,
him,
no.
Him and him alone. But thank you very much to you both. That's our naughty special done right there. I'll be back soon with another special podcast. We'll be playing some of the best tracks recorded especially for us over the course of 2009 from the likes of Frightened Rabbit and Hockey, amongst others. We'll hopefully see you then. But on behalf of me, myself, Rosie and Paul, goodbye.